Welcome to Juno Afternoon on this Friday. Welcome to Juno Afternoon on this Friday. I'm Christina Michelle, your host for this hour. Coming up, a conversation with a man who put the pedal to the metal for 6,000 miles on a ride from the Florida Keys to Prudhoe Bay. A new incarnation for worn-out fishnets, one that gives them a new purpose. Also, in our weekly Juno Audubon Society, Birds of the Week, we'll get to know more about hairy woodpeckers, Arctic terns, and sea ducks called surf scoters. Now the forecast. We've got a stretch of wet weather into next week. Tonight, scattered rain showers. Lows around 50. South winds at 10 miles per hour. Tomorrow, scattered showers continue. Juno Afternoon will be right back after National Native News. You're listening to Juno Afternoon. Thank you for being here with us today. I'm Christina Michelle. Have bike, will travel, and boy did he travel, about 6,000 miles from the Florida Keys to Prudhoe Bay. That was 2 years ago. Today, Gary Radford is 64 years old and still finding new frontiers. He's here in Juneau to visit his daughter. Welcome to Juneau, Gary.
Thank you, Christina.
So did you bring your bicycle with you?
No, I did not on this trip, but I did work on my daughter's bicycle yesterday.
Does she cycle as well?
Not to the extent that I do.
Okay, maybe one day.
Yes.
So, Gary, where is home for you?
Cicero, New York, just a little bit north of Syracuse, about 300 miles from New York City.
Okay, nice. And what is it like there during this time? It's a little rainy for us.
Beautiful. Our summers are incredible. We're on the lee of Lake Ontario. Days are not real hot. Nights usually are comfortable. Winters, we get quite a bit of snow. You know, 150 inches of snow is not uncommon for the winter there. But, you know, like Juno and the rain, you learn how to deal with it and you thrive eventually.
Absolutely. Well, what made you decide to go on a 6,000-mile bicycle trip?
Well, I thought it would be a challenge. I wanted to do it to inspire people to push their limits, to not only physically but mentally. And I had been a long-distance cyclist before this. I had twice before cycled across the United States from San Francisco to Bar Harbor, Maine. And the last time that I did that trip, I did it with my wife. So I had somebody understanding that when I broached this subject that I wasn't thrown out of the house. So I just wanted to push my limits. And also, I belong to an elite running club, and I wanted to do something for our running club. So I set up this this challenge where people could donate a penny a mile to support me and to support the club. All the money, 100%, went to the club.
Nice.
And we raised over $12,000 for the running club. And our running club supports youth programs, post-collegiate runners, hopefully future Olympians, masters runners like myself. And we're kind of a cradle-to-the-grave running club. And I wanted to give back to the Genesee Valley Harriers, which I belong to.
Wow, that's fantastic. So you said that you started to really push your limits. And I'm wondering, like, how did you come up with the route that you chose?
Took a look at a map with a friend of mine. Did all blue highways. If you took a look at the old maps that you used to get from like AAA and stuff, those blue highways are the little two-lane roads that run crisscross across America and Canada. And just picked out a route that was pretty direct. You know, it's kind of diagonal from Key West up to Prudhoe Bay. Mm-hmm. And you had to pick places also where there were towns, you know, riding 12, sometimes 14, 16 hours a day. You wanted to be able to run into maybe a convenience store,
yeah,
or a restaurant and, you know, fuel up. And we chose the route like that, but it was harder and harder the farther north you got. Once you got up into, you know, western Minnesota, into North Dakota, and then up in the Canadian provinces, you know, the towns were fewer and far between, so you had to plan ahead more as far as carrying the food with you. And I did this all unsupported. I had a bicycle with panniers, bags, saddlebags, front and rear on the bike, and I had sleeping bag, tent, cook stove, spare parts for the bicycle, week's worth of food with me, and all together with the bicycle, I had 104 and a half pounds of gear that I was toting.
Oh, my goodness.
And I tell people that are used to riding, you know, like a 10-speed bicycle, you know, everybody's been on a 10-speed. Well, that would be kind of like a Miata sports car compared to what I was riding would be like a Peterbilt tractor trailer. Much heavier, a little bit harder to propel, a lot harder to stop. And you had to plan your moves ahead, you know, a little bit more. And it was a challenge.
I can imagine. So how did you manage meal times and, you know?
Well, I was eating constantly. I was burning between 5,000 and 6,000 calories a day. And wow. Being in constant motion, being in that saddle 12 to 16 hours a day, you really had to make sure that you kept the fuel in you constantly. You couldn't start out in the morning and not have a good breakfast and not really have anything until lunchtime, or you're going to bonk. You're going to reach a point where you're not going to come back that day.
Yeah.
And, you know, it's detrimental to your health. So, you know, you get up in the morning, eat some breakfast, ride for maybe a couple hours, stop for another breakfast, ride a bit more. You're constantly eating things like power bars or drinking Gatorade, stopping for lunch, and eating through the afternoon. And I would do that as I was riding. You know, I would just keep that food going in. Certainly made sure I had the fluids in me.
Sure.
Especially when you're down in the southern states. You know, I had temperatures in the high 90s. I had one day it was 101 degrees in South Florida.
Ooh.
So you had to make sure that you had, you know, the fluids in you. But as you got farther north, you had to worry about being cold and being dressed for that. And that made it much harder. That and not being able to stop everywhere for food. I was eating more freeze-dried food.
Okay.
Wasn't getting, I don't think, the caloric intake that I needed. And I might have been able to last another week or maybe two. At the end of it, I was really starting to get thin, and I think that maybe my body would have been in trouble if I had to go much more than that. So,
I'm glad you listened to your body.
That's right. That's right. But boy, I was pretty fit by the end of it, and very lean.
That is so awesome. What was your experience like with people as you were traveling?
It was the best part of the whole trip,
without a doubt.
People see you on a bicycle, and they see you all loaded down with gear, and the first question out of their mouth is, where are you coming from?
Yeah.
You know, and in the beginning, you know, if you're in like Key Largo and you say, oh, well, I started in Key West, not much of a big deal. And then they'd ask, the second question was always, well, where are you going to? I say, well, Prudhoe Bay, Alaska. Well, when you're in Key Largo, you're getting laughter after that second question. You know, what are you dreaming? Is this a pipe dream? You know, but the farther along you got on this journey, you know, you'd say, well, I started 3 weeks ago in Key West, and now you're in North Dakota. You know, they're looking at you, and that's inspiring you. They go,
absolutely.
Wow, you're going to Prudhoe Bay. That's awesome. You know, so the farther you went, you kind of built on that. And, you know, people inspired me as much as hopefully I inspired them.
Yeah. It reminds me of Boris Gump and when he just started running.
That's right. Well, I didn't get up to Prudhoe Bay and turn around and come back again.
That's really cool. So, you can't take much on your bike, and you already talked about some of the things that you did have on there. How did you manage, like, your time, like, during the day? I know you said that you would stop a couple times to eat and things like that, but did you have a plan?
Well, I did have a plan in one respect that I would look at each. I break things down into manageable bits. Mm-hmm. When you start out on a journey like this, it can be overwhelming. You know, you're in Key West and you're looking north and you're thinking, you know, 2 months from now, you know, hopefully I'm going to be up in Alaska. That's an awful lot to comprehend, you know, to swallow. Mm-hmm. But if you looked at the morning that you were in and said, okay, I'm going to deal with this morning. This is my ride. This is kind of where I think that I can stop, but I don't know because I've never been to these places before. You might roll into what looks like a town on a map, and it might have been a town at one time, and it isn't any longer. You have to adjust to that. But you just have to break it down. You don't look at tomorrow or next week or next month. You just look at the moment you're in. You look at that morning, and you know, after a while, all of a sudden, you know, you're in Minnesota. You know, how did that happen? Because I was just worrying about this morning. And I think in life, you know, there's a lot of life lessons there that many times in life we get overwhelmed with whatever it is in our situation. And if we can just break things down into manageable bits and look at maybe just this hour or maybe, you know, if you have substance abuse or whatever, that minute or whatever, and just deal with the moment.
Absolutely.
And then you can build on that.
Yeah, that's a great point. Yeah, I was thinking, you know, if you've got this huge, you know, trip ahead of you, like what keeps you going? Was there any times when you felt like you wanted to turn back?
Oh, there's times, you know, being in the prairie and having a headwind that's blowing 25 or 30 miles an hour for 12 hours straight. Oof. And you're just looking at the next telephone pole and saying, I'm going to make it to the next pole, then the next pole.
Yes.
And you might look ahead and see that grain elevator off in the distance. And you say, after so many poles, I'm going to be there. And then you look at the next pole, and that goes on for 12 hours.
Oh, my
goodness.
Then
you wake up the next morning, and the wind's blowing just as hard. You know, it takes some mental perseverance. It does. And I think that I've built some of that through my life. Certainly that trip made me tougher. And, you know, I'm not a young guy either. I'm 64 years old. And I think as we age, we might not be as physically strong as we were back, you know, 30 or 40 years ago, but I think we learn a lot about patience and how to understand our body, how to be patient and let things come to you. I rode my bicycle up every hill and every mountain along the way. I never got off and pushed my bicycle. Not one foot I didn't.
Wow.
But I had this mantra that I'd let the hill come to me. I would sit back there and I would just spin and I wouldn't worry about the top. I would just let that hill just move towards me. And I think that you do little mental things like that to get you through those tough times, you know, count those telephone poles or whatever.
Yeah. Yeah. That is so relatable to life. Like you said, it's just,
it is, isn't it? It is.
So what, new records did you set for yourself? I can imagine there were probably dozens, if not hundreds.
Well, I think that we anytime we do something as challenging, we come away from it a little bit more enlightened. Mm. I can't say that without a doubt nobody has done this trip before because you really don't know. I know that mine is documented, that I had a satellite tracker with me and people could follow me online. They could look at my satellite tracker.
Okay.
They could see the direction I was going in, how fast I was going, what elevation I was at.
Yeah.
And so I have documentation that I did the trip. There's no question about that. But, you know, maybe somebody else, you know, beforehand had done that. So I never looked at it like I was trying to set some kind of record. Mm. People have asked me, well, you know, did you submit anything to Guinness Book of World Records? And that's really not me, you know. That's not what I was looking for. I was just looking to challenge myself and also looking to inspire other people to say, hey, you know what, this guy did this. Maybe I'll get my bike out tonight and I'll ride around the block and maybe a week from now I'll go a little bit farther, and you know what? this guy did this. He's, you know, 62 years old. Boy, you know, I'm 55. I can do something. Maybe I'll go on a bike trip, you know?
Yes.
So that's what I was looking for.
Nice. Well, now I have a new example of...
You ready to go for a bike trip?
Oh, maybe. Maybe. But I hear a lot of people saying, you know, even, you know, just standing up and their knees crack or something and they're like,
oh, mine do that.
It's because I'm getting old. And I'm like, yeah, well, you know.
Yeah.
But part of that is it's just in your mind.
That's right. That's right.
And I can say, well, I know Gary, okay.
Right. Well, I have my aches and pains. And actually, 8 months before I left on this trip, I tore my Achilles tendon.
Ooh.
And I had to have surgery. And I was in a running race and, you know, hoping to do well in the race. And right before the finish, bang, I just tore my Achilles, practically did a cartwheel, and had to have surgery. They took the tendon out of my big toe, and they made an Achilles tendon out of it. So I can't bend my big toe now. And they said, well, geez, we think you can walk around without a limp, but we're not really sure how well you're going to be able to do running from here on out. So I was in a cast and in a boot, you know, several months, and got in a pool and started aqua jogging with a flotation belt on, not touching the bottom of the pool, started swimming a bit, got on a bicycle, and started spinning on the bike, and went to the Y, and I'd get on the bike in the morning, and I'd be on it for an hour, and then a little while later, it might be 2 hours, and after a while, the staff was coming in at the Y in the morning, and I was on the bicycle. They'd take a lunch break and go out to lunch. I was still on the bicycle.
Oh,
and they'd leave to go home at 5 o'clock at night, and I was still on the bicycle. And before I left on this trip, I did 4,000 miles on the bicycle, and I was training 8 to 10 hours a day just to be prepared for it. And I reached a point in the spring, I said, geez, I'm getting pretty fit on the bike here. And, you know, I want to do something that's challenging, and came up with this idea and started looking at routes and put the thing together in about a month's time, actually. I really decided about May 1st that that's when I told my wife anyway. And she goes, you're really going to do this? I said, yeah, you know, this wasn't a joke. And yeah, I left June 1st from Key West and arrived up in Prudhoe Bay on the 5th of August. And 66 days altogether. It was 5,535.25 miles, but who's counting? And and I had to push myself. You know, it might have been easier to do it in the other direction because the weather would have been nicer down south longer, but I thought it would be tougher to go from Key West up to Prudhoe Bay because I know the summers up in the Arctic are so short. So, and actually when I got above the Arctic Circle and I was in the Brooks Range, I had a couple of snowstorms that I battled that last week. And, you know, I had some days the temperature, you know, would be starting out in upper 20s and some snow. And there's lots of mud up on that Dalton Highway. And I carried a toilet bowl brush with my bicycle and I'd have to whisk off either the mud or the snow, you know, every so often. And, it was definitely got tougher the farther north that I went.
Yeah. You said you were working or biking 8 to 10 hours a day even before your trip. So that sounds almost like an obsession.
Well, it has to be. If you're going to do something like that, you have to be prepared. You can't hop on a bicycle and plan on doing anything that long and wind up being healthy. Just sitting on a leather bicycle saddle for 12, 14, 16 hours a day, you better be pretty
prepared
in a lot of ways, you know, not only the mental part of it of being on a bicycle that long, but the physical, just sitting down, you know. You talk to any person that's on a long distance bicycle trip and you ask them what the toughest part is, and a lot of them will say the toughest part is sitting, you know.
What do your wife and daughter think of all this?
hopefully they're inspired by it.
Yeah.
My wife, as I said earlier, rode across the United States with me before, and we've done some shorter bicycle trips, New York up to Maine in recent years. We rode out to visit some friends in Kansas a few years back. So she kind of understands what long-distance cycling is about, and she certainly understands how I'm wired, and maybe that's one of the reasons why she married me. I don't know.
That's beautiful. So, Gary, what's next for you?
That's a good question. I got to give a little bit of time here to absorb some of this. I'm working on a book right now. But there'll be other challenges. Just off the top of my head, I was pretty intrigued when I crossed the Mississippi River and looked at that river and thought, boy, wouldn't it be kind of cool to hop in a kayak and maybe start up in the headwaters in Minnesota and go down to New Orleans. And I've thought about that. I'd be interested. A shorter trip, I'd like to try to cross Death Valley in the summertime. I think that would be a challenge. And certainly I want to someday, hopefully with my wife, travel across the southern part of the United States from maybe like San Diego to St. Augustine, Florida, and cycle across the southern states. I haven't done that before, and I think that would be a fun trip.
Yeah.
Yeah. Maybe not 100-mile days, but, you know, maybe like 50-mile days and, you know, kind of take it all in slowly.
Do you still bike every day now?
Most often on this trip, I've been up in Alaska now going on 3 weeks just on a vacation.
Okay.
So we rented an RV, you know, and did
nice.
The camping thing. And I've done quite a bit of camping in Alaska in the past. So left the bicycle at home, believe it or not. But before that, I probably got maybe going on 3,000 miles in this year on the bicycle so far.
Oh, my goodness. You're about 2,950 miles ahead of me.
Yeah. You know, and mostly they're shorter rides, you know. Where I live is a beautiful place to ride. Upstate New York, there's hills, there's areas that are flat, there's the Finger Lakes, which are beautiful. And just out my door, I can have flatter hills, and I can have it all. So it's really nice. But there's other trips planned for the future. I just got to have a little bit of time before I say anything right now. So,
well, Gary, I don't know if all of us are ready to ride 6,000 miles, but how do we get started on our own journeys towards reclaiming our health?
Well, do a little bit at a time, you know. Walk out that door, walk around the block. Don't try to do anything epic right from the start. Keep it very small. Build on that. Hardest part, without a doubt, is just getting your butt out the door.
Yeah.
Once you start, it gets easier. It does. And after a while, it becomes a habit. And that's the main thing. You don't have to do anything like this, but just do a little bit each day. And, you know, it's good for you mentally and certainly physically.
Absolutely. Great advice. Gary Radford, thanks for coming to Juno Afternoon to share your inspiring story and for giving us some of your time during your visit with your daughter.
Well, thank you. This is my pleasure.
We appreciate it.
Support for Juno Afternoon comes from Heritage Coffee Roasting Company, providing Juno with locally roasted coffee for over 40 years, with cafes and drive-through locations throughout Juno. More at heritagecoffee.com.
Great to have you here with us on Juno Afternoon. I'm Christina Michelle, your host for today. So what happens to fishing nets when they outlive their usefulness? Juno is a fishing community, so that means there are likely a lot of old nets lying around, especially when they're banned from the landfill. But the city and borough of Juno and a Seattle company called Net Your Problem have teamed up to get these nets out of Juno so they can be repurposed. It's kind of one of those win-win stories. And here to tell us about this program, Stuart Ashton, the operations manager for Recycle Works, and Nicole Baker with Net Your Problem. Stuart, let's start with you.
Hi.
Hi. Welcome to Juno Afternoon.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
So why can't these nets go in the landfill along with other trash?
Well, technically they can, but the local landfill owner and operator, Waste Management, basically said that they don't want that material in there. Hopefully it's because a lot of the material is recyclable and we can do something better with it than bury it forever.
Okay, and Nicole, hello, welcome.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Absolutely. Nicole, what led you to start your company, Net Your Problem?
Well, I used to be a fisheries observer. I have a master's degree in marine biology. So one of my first jobs out of college was a scientist that was collecting data about commercial fisheries in Alaska. So we would live on boats and travel around with them and be in ports like Dutch Harbor and Kodiak and Accutane. And I just saw a lot of old nets lying around. And these were trawl nets, which is different than what we're going to be talking about today. But the idea is the same, that there are a lot of old nets sitting around in lots of ports in Alaska and elsewhere. And once I realized they were made out of plastic and that there were recycling companies that specialize in accepting this material, I thought, why shouldn't we be doing this?
Wow. I heard that no piece of plastic is ever actually disintegrates. Is that true? That it has to be recycled?
Yeah, from my understanding, yeah, they just break down into smaller and smaller and smaller and smaller pieces. So recycling is a way of actually capturing that plastic and getting it back into the supply chain for another use.
Nice. And what exactly do you do with these nets once you get them?
Our role is that of a broker. So that's how I describe what our business does. If you think about a real estate broker, for example, that person knows who has houses to sell and who wants to buy them. And they match those two people up. And so that's similarly what we do with the nets. I know that Stuart and Juno have some to get rid of. And I also know what companies or businesses are looking for those nets as a raw material for their recycling factories. So we don't actually process any of the nets or recycle them ourselves or make any of the products, but we facilitate the transfer of those materials to those companies that do.
I see. Okay. Stuart, can people just bring you their gill nets, or do you have to prep them in some way?
Yeah, well, definitely they got to be prepped. We've got a couple PSAs out there and flyers and whatnot that we've worked with. Nicole, actually, we're using some of her documentation and whatnot that basically show you what you need to take off of it. And it's basically the webbing is what we're looking for. The other stuff, it's not the same material. It's not as easy, and Nicole can talk more to it. But as long as it's prepped and basically meaning anything that's not recyclable taken off, you contact me and we set up a time that's convenient for you. I make sure that it is proper and then it goes along with all the other stuff waiting to get shipped down to Nicole.
Okay. Can either Stuart, you or Nicole, explain to us what the harm is of just letting these nets sit around?
I definitely feel that Nicole has a lot more experience seeing that other than, because myself, other than that, it's just any kind of ghost netting and whatnot. There's tons of articles and just videos and things you can see of anything that we leave in the ocean, especially nets that aren't actually checked and whatnot. They're just destroying life out there. I'm sure, again, Nicole can probably give you a more firsthand account of what she's seen.
Yeah, I think for me, it's just a waste of a resource. So we like to think about nets and even other plastic items that can be recycled. When those are taken to the landfill, that's causing us to have to extract petroleum from the ground and use it to make virgin plastic, to make some of the plastic products that we need or use in our life. So if we take that stuff to the landfill, I think it's wasting resources. So we want to keep that stuff in the supply chain as much as possible. So the rationale for recycling fishing gear is the same as why you would want to recycle water bottles or milk jugs. And I think, you know, what Stuart is saying about stuff being in the environment that causes pollution, it harms animals and wildlife just the same like any other kind of plastic does. So we want to just be managing the waste that we generate as responsibly as possible. And that's what I think we're trying to do in Juneau with the gill nets, just give fishermen a responsible way of getting rid of the materials that they use to make their livelihoods.
Okay. Stuart, your mission seems to be to keep stuff out of the landfill. So you must know how much trash goes in there every year. What percent of the waste are you able to divert through recycling?
Well, yes, we basically the landfill here, and not we, but Waste Management, the private entity that owns it, they take in about 30,000 tons a year. And that's pretty consistent. It does grow a little bit, but it's pretty consistent. Juneau is a pretty consistent place, thankfully, for a lot of reasons. And depending on which metrics you're looking at, we divert anywhere from 6 to 11%. That's, you know, up to 11 is when we're talking about the recycling program that the CBJ contracts to have the recycling center, and then also Alaska Waste, the curbside pickup and whatnot. You know, we can probably get up to about 11% annually is what we're stopping from going in there by offering these services.
Okay, and Nicole, how much progress are you making in collecting these old nets?
Well, we've been in business since the summer of 2017, so we just ticked over 4 years doing this work in Alaska and elsewhere, and we have collected 440 tons of nets, or 971,000 pounds since we started. So I think we are, thanks. It's nothing compared to Stuart's 30,000 tons of garbage that he has, but we're trying to grow. We're trying to expand to include other locations in Alaska. So this year we're working with Stuart and then also another Southeast community, Haines. And we've got a part-time employee that's working in Maine to start a lobster line recycling program there. So there are fisheries all over the U.S. on all of the coasts that generate fishing gear that is recyclable. So we're trying to expand to those places as well. And I think the model that we have going on in Juneau here, where the city is providing this recycling program to the fishermen, is something that I would really like to replicate. I think the cities and the boroughs are definitely need to be involved in providing this service to their residents. In some places where we're trying to establish operations, taking nets to the landfill is free and legal and widely accepted as a possible disposal option. So that makes it really challenging to charge fishermen for recycling. So if you can have the leadership of the municipalities to provide this as a service, that can really make it so that it works out.
Okay. Well, Stuart, I'm going to go to you. What is one main thing that you really want people to know about the work that you're doing?
Oh, goodness.
You can say more than one if you want.
Fair enough. All right. Are you looking for all of our programs or just the general Recycle Works, you know, entity and CBJ? Are you looking more for the gillnet side that we're talking about now?
Well, mainly for the gillnet side, but anything that you're passionate about, most passionate about, I should say.
Fair enough.
Well, Nicole, I'm going to ask really, you the really, same thing, just so you know.
Well, I'm first off is I've only been doing this position for 5 or 6 years, and I took over from a gentleman named Jim Panor, who started most of the Recycle Works programs, and the Gillnet one was one of his that he really wanted to get off the ground, and unfortunately they're just. Well, basically, Nicole wasn't out there for us to find. And so I'm really, really happy that right after he left, we actually found Nicole, and we've been working with her since trying to get this off the ground and get it going. And so this is actually one of my passion ones, is because I wanted to get that done for him. And I'm really excited to be able to contact him again and say, hey, we're actually making shipments, and getting the stuff out of the water and out of the landfill and whatnot. You know, so this is definitely my passion one, mostly because it affords me the opportunity to go down to the dock and visit the docks and harbor guys and ladies, because I love being on the water. Anything that has to do with fishing, even if I'm not involved in it, I'm all about.
Nice. And the same question to you, Nicole. What would you most like us to know about what you do and why you're so passionate about it?
I'm glad I came second, because it gave me a chance here to think what I want to say. So I've got two things that I'd like to share. One is Stuart sort of teed me up to talk about how to prepare nets properly, but I didn't follow through with that. So I would like to say that if you are a fisherman and you would like to participate in this recycling program, it is super important that you are dropping off nets that are prepared properly. So that means taking off the cork line, the corks, the hanging twine, and the lead line, and a weed line if you use one. So those are all parts of a gill net that are made out of a different type of plastic than the actual nylon web, which is what the recyclers are interested in. And some of the nets that Stuart had sent me pictures of that people had dropped off previously have some of those materials on there. It is so, so, so time consuming and difficult to go through nets that have been dropped off already and take off these materials. So when you're stripping a net, do this right when you're stripping the net, and then bring us the clean product. And in the press releases that Stuart mentioned earlier, we've put together a video showing how to do this. It requires a little bit extra time, but if you want to recycle, this is what you need to do. We really cannot be accepting materials that are not prepared properly, because we would need an army of volunteers spending the whole summer in order to make the nets compliant for recycling. So if you don't want to spend the extra time, you need to find something else to do with your gill nets, but don't bring them to Stuart. That's number one. And then the second thing is that this is a little bit more of a esoteric or high level kind of thing, but you know, people do recycling because they can make money from that. Generally speaking, the recycling factories receive raw materials and then sell those to make other kinds of products. And I think a lot of people believe that recycling is something that we want to do because it's good for the earth and we should have to get grants and have volunteers and all this kind of stuff. And that your problem is actually a for-profit business. We're providing a service to municipalities and the fishing industry. So I would just like people to have that kind of in their mind that, you know, I was motivated to do recycling because I want to do something good for the environment. But ultimately, recycling is a business, all of the factories that do that. So it is important that what we are essentially selling to the recycling companies is what they have agreed to purchase from us, going back again to having things prepared properly, because these are raw materials for them to then sell on into products that are being manufactured lately. So recycling is kind of cool because there is like a feel good, do something good for the environment kind of approach, while at the same time being a sustainable way to make a living, hopefully.
Okay. Thank you, Nicole. Stuart, did you want to add anything?
Not so much, but I will jump onto Nicole's sentiment that if you're going to recycle, please do it the right way. Doing it incorrectly, whether it's gill nets, whether it's, you know, just bringing your material to us, it makes it much, much more cumbersome, expensive, even to the point where we actually can't get rid of the recycled material if it's not done correctly. So utilize our website and whatever else you need, you know, reach out to me. Like, I'll talk recycling all day long, but if you're going to do it, and please do it right.
Okay. Well, thank you so much for taking the time to explain to us how gill nets can be recycled and for giving us a proper protocol for recycling. Nicole Baker with Net Your Problem and Stuart Ashton, manager for Recycle Works.
Thank you for having us.
Appreciate it. Can't wait to get your nets later, Stuart.
Yeah.
Support comes from Nugget Alaskan Outfitter, providing Juno with clothing for every occasion. Bonfires, weddings, casual dinner parties, and more. Online at nuggetoutfitter.com or in person at the Mendenhall Mall.
Welcome back to Juno Afternoon. I'm Christina Michelle. So good to be here with you today. This summer, we've been checking in with Brenda Wright from the Juno Audubon Society every Friday. She picks out three birds to spotlight. But first, we always like to find out about Brenda's latest bird watching adventure. Hi, Brenda. How's the bird watching?
Hi, Christina. Michelle, it's very nice to meet you. The bird watching has been amazing today for eagles. Would you believe when I was by the Pioneer Marsh at the Pioneer Home today, I saw 32 eagles circling up into the air just because.
Oh, wow. I always wonder why the eagles like to hang out over there in that area, but I've never seen that many at a time.
Yeah, there's an amazing updraft that comes from the valley and the way the mountains are shaped there. And so those wonderful smells wafting up from the landfill, and a beautiful place to drift up into the air and spy on everyone.
That makes sense. So you've picked out three birds this week, the hairy woodpecker, the Arctic tern, and a sea duck called the surf scoter. And I think we have a little audio of what each of these sound like. But can you describe what they look like, starting with the hairy woodpecker?
Okay, yeah, the hairy woodpecker is one of our birds that live with us a year round. So it's one of those ones that it can find something to eat all winter. It's a small woodpecker, and it's one of the ones that's mostly black and white. So it's got black wings, white back, barred markings on its side, and the male has a little red cockade, and the female's just black and white headed. They're just about as big as your hand. And they love dead trees.
Okay. And how about the Arctic tern?
Oh, the Arctic tern is one of our most amazing travelers. Would you believe the terns that come here to have their babies come all the way from Patagonia, Argentina?
What?
It's so hard to believe. Arctic terns are world travelers.
Oh, my goodness. How long does it take small bird to get here? Oh, I'm sorry.
It's white, mm-hmm. but it's got a black cap, and it's got a very, very sharply pointed wings and a forked tail. And when you hear the sound, you'll know that you've heard it somewhere in town, because they love to eat small, very small fish, like minnow size.
Okay.
And they go to all the best fishing places.
Okay, and how about the surf scoter?
Yeah, this duck is one of the marine birds that stay with us almost all year round. They like to eat blue mussels and other aquatic invertebrates. So they come and they stay near shore often. They're mostly black, but some interesting white markings on their head, their forehead and the back of their head. And they're quite black. The females are a little bit more brownish. But these birds stay with us most of the winter, because there's good food around here, and the ocean doesn't freeze. So they stay mostly because it's plentiful. And the most amazing thing about them, I think, is that almost all of them from here go straight up to Skagway and take a right to the Yukon Territory and nest up there.
Ah, okay. And how often do we see the scoters? How long do they, or when do they come, and how long do they stay?
Well, you know, they have such an interesting life pattern. They're here almost all the time between September and May, because they're getting, in the early spring, they're looking for hooligan and herring to get lots of protein to build those eggs. And then they go off for the males just for a couple months, and find a nice place up in the Yukon. Each pair of birds wants one single little pool all their own. And then the males you know, as soon as the babies hatch, bye, see you later. Come back down here and molt.
Okay, well, let's take a listen to what each of these birds sound like. We can start with the hairy woodpecker. Okay, so it's kind of like a slow rhythmic tweet. I'm pretty sure I've heard this one waking me up quite a few times.
Yeah, they're not quite as loud of banging, hammering noise as the sapsucker, but they do live around us all everywhere around us, and they when they have a territory, they'll let you know that that's their territory.
I love it. Okay, let's listen to the Arctic tern.
Well, that's not what we call a melody, but it is certainly a way to identify that the bird is around you and close to you, and you might be stepping in their territory just a little too close.
Got it. Yeah, that's not the one that I want to wake up to in the morning. Okay, and how about the surf scoter? Nice.
So the nice thing about the scoters, they're often just as far enough offshore, so you can't quite tell. They're just a line of maybe 100 or even 300 black birds in a row. But when they take off, you can definitely hear that sound of their wings. It's very, very distinctive, and they're the only ones that sound like that.
Okay. Brenda, can you tell us quickly how did this duck get its name, the scoter?
The scoter? Oh, you know, you've got me stumped there. I'm not really sure.
Okay.
There's three different kinds, and they're actually circumpolar, and so I know in Britain they have a different name, but I can't think of what that is either at the moment. It's just like our loons. We call them loons. They call them something else.
Okay.
So I'm not sure where they got the scoter name.
Okay. Well, thank you so much, Brenda Wright, with the Juno Audubon Society, for helping us to get to know some of the birds in our backyard.
I hope everybody can get out and enjoy them in the sunny spots between the rain.
Absolutely. I'll be listening for some of those noises now, and I'll know what I'm looking for.
All right.
Thanks. Have a good afternoon.
Support for Juno Afternoon is provided by Hanson Gress, Heritage Coffee Roasting Company, and Klingit and Haida Social Enterprises. For more information, visit ktoo.org/JunoAfternoon.
That'll do it for Juno Afternoon. Broadcast live on KTOO 104.3 FM, online at ktoo.org, and repeated at 4 on KRNN 102.7 FM.